I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. The Invisible War is not an easy documentary to watch, but it's an important one to see. It's about the prevalence of rape and sexual assault in the U.S. military, told in moving and vivid detail by the victims, whom the filmmakers call survivors. Here's a montage from the film representing women who served in the Army, Air Force, Marine Corps, and Navy, talking about retaliation after reporting sexual abuse.
When you report something, you better be prepared for the repercussions.
If a man gets accused of rape, it's a setup. The woman's lying.
I could choose to report it, but if they found that what I was saying wasn't to be truthful, then that I would be reduced in rank.
You could lose your rate, you could lose rank, you could lose your school if you file a false report. So do you want to file a report?
Even with the rape kit and everything, my friend catching him raping me, they still don't believe me.
I reported it two different times to my squad leader. And he told me that there was nothing he can do about it because I didn't have any proof.
They actually did charge me with adultery. I wasn't married, he was.
They took me before my lieutenant commander. He says, "Do you think this is funny?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Is this all a joke to you?" I was like, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "You're the third girl to report rape this week. Are you guys like all in cahoots? Do you think this is a game?"
The Defense Department says that almost 23,000 sex crimes were committed last year in the military. The filmmakers and those they interviewed say that most of these crimes go unreported. The film explores why so few perpetrators are brought to justice. Amy Ziering, the producer of The Invisible War, joins us on Radio Times. She's an Emmy-nominated, award-winning producer and director, conducted many of the interviews for The Invisible War. And Amy Ziering, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, nice to be here.
Also with us is Anu Bhagwati, and she's executive director, co-founder of Service Women's Action Network. She's a former captain, company commander, served as a Marine officer from 1999 to 2004. And Anu Bhagwati, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
And to you, Amy, and I have to say it was very difficult to watch your film, but as I said, an important one to see. How much convincing did you have to go through to get these women, and there are some men, but get these women to talk?
Well, actually, it was very hard initially to find all the people we did talk with, but once I did find them, they were actually extremely grateful to talk. And they felt like, you know, no one had really listened and heard them. So that part wasn't so difficult. The challenge was because of the fear and distrust they had, due to all the things they'd experienced, not only from the assault, but everything in its aftermath. They were reluctant to sort of, come forward. But once, I made contact and sort of gained their trust, they were extremely grateful to just have a voice and, you know, be heard and have someone listen to them and not challenge them and feel in a comfortable, safe environment.
And I want to pick up on all that. To you, Anu Bhagwati, was this a shocking film?
No, it wasn't shocking to me. It was very hard to watch because it's, I think the filmmakers did a great job of bringing a face to this crisis. It wasn't shocking because I've been doing this work for many years, and even when I was in the Marine Corps as an officer, I saw a lot of sexual assault and harassment, and my own commanders would sweep these incidents under the rug even when I tried to resolve the problem. So it wasn't surprising. I think what's shocking is just the sheer magnitude of the problem and the amount of retaliation that we see. But people have a hard time kind of comprehending that retaliation could exist in the military. I think, Americans hold the military in very high regard. And so it's hard to integrate these two different versions of the military.
Is there any way to know, Anu, just how common sexual assault is in the military?
Well, it's very common. Some branches have done their own internal surveys. For instance, the Air Force last year did its own internal Gallup survey, and women, one out of five women said that they had been sexually assaulted, and one out of 20 men said that they had been sexually assaulted. So these are very high numbers, and that's actually the same number of men and women in the Air Force. But we imagine that, in other branches of the military, assault might even be worse because there are fewer women in those other branches. For instance, the Marine Corps is only 6% female, while the Air Force is 20%. 20%. So, you know, there's just a huge culture of silence across the military, across all ranks, you know, enlisted and officer. And so what we're trying to do is you know, bring visibility to this issue, put a human face on this issue, and not give up.
Well, and Amy, one of these human faces is a young woman named Corey, served in the Coast Guard. First of all, how did you find her, and help us understand her story?
Corey, we found through a lost, working with a lawyer, Susan Burke. There was a lawyer, just like the director and I sort of stumbled upon this through an article in Salon a few years ago, and we were, you know, completely shocked by what we read, and then started doing our own investigating and reaching out and talking to people, and knew it was actually one of the first phone calls we made. And and we, as we kept doing our research, we became even more, everything we'd read, it was even worse than we'd ever expected, as a new set. And what's really important and everyone needs to understand is that it's not just the assault, it's everything that happens afterwards to these people, which is what, as the news just pointed out, is so shocking and not well known in the American public. And so we found, reached out to Susan Burke, who's a lawyer, who also had done her own research into this issue and decided that she wanted to do something. And she was pulling together a lawsuit on behalf of survivors of sexual assault. And Corey was one of her plaintiffs, and that's how we found her.
And she had served in the U.S. Coast Guard, and she has a family, a husband and a child. We meet them, we see them living together, as she describes it. In a very tearful interview, she talks about being raped. She talks about having her commanding officer essentially doing nothing, having her jaw dislocated. This was a woman who was seriously abused in the Coast Guard.
Yeah, she was sort of really terrorized. I mean, she was a very small, diminutive woman, very strong and tough, and had already always gotten by, you know, being very tough. And she was in an environment where she was quite isolated and surprised to see that she couldn't use those resources, you know, to her defense anymore. And it was so bad that her assailant, other people came to her defense and went and complained on her behalf, you know, and even then her commander didn't do anything. And that was what was really sort of heartbreaking and appalling for her. And she was sort of trapped with this really sort of sadistic person who kept terrorizing her.
Well, and picking up on that, Anu, and going back to you and helping us understand this chain of command and why the military, broadly speaking, hasn't taken these accusations, these charges more seriously.
Well, the military is starting to take accusations seriously at the highest level because of films like The Invisible War, because of the recent media attention on this crisis, because there are literally thousands of victims stepping forward, both women and men. And so the military leadership at the highest levels, you know, the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chiefs have no choice but to step forward and say that they're going to do something about it. The problem is that we've got an enormous bureaucracy within the military, and within each unit, you have a chain of command, and the chain of command exists in the military for a very good reason, which is that in a operational environment, you know, you need to take orders from people who are senior to you and not question those orders. And some of the things that you'll be doing in an operational environment are completely counterintuitive, like running at bullets that are flying at you, these types of things. And so, the chain of command in an operational environment tends to function well. Where it doesn't function well is with what the military considers personnel issues, and certainly crimes which have a gender component. And so sexual assault is still really considered a headache for many unit commanders. They'd rather not deal with it. They'd rather just focus on war fighting. And so what you see is that the women and men who step forward are largely considered, you know, just thorns in, you know, in the unit. And therefore are not taken seriously. And of course, underlying all of that is a very strong rape mythology, which, you know, exists throughout society, but it's very extreme in the military, where women and men are assumed to be lying. You know, they're called whores. They're told that they're exaggerating what happened to them, that they made it up, they misunderstood. The so-called perpetrator, you know, didn't mean to do that, or, you know, why are you bringing down a good man's career, and so on and so forth.
Amy, going back to you, and actually, as I was reading that Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has seen your film, and it sounds like a couple of days after that film, he took some action.
Yeah, he did see the film, and then 2 days later, he held a press conference and announced some changes. And so we were very heartened by that. He told one of our executive producers that seeing the film in part was what led to him taking these kind of actions.
And what actions did he take?
Well, he moved the decision to investigate and prosecute these crimes up the chain of command, so it's no longer exclusively in the hands of the unit commanders, but has moved up to colonel or captain level if you're in the Navy.
You want to add to that?
One of the things. And Anu can amplify what's thought of that change. And also another change was to institute a special investigation unit for these crimes.
You want to expand on that, Anu?
Sure. Well, the SVU units, which, I mean, you know, Americans will commonly recognize from, you know, watching Law and Order SVU, is a good step. The other sort of technical reform that Amy was referring to is moving case disposition higher up the chain of command. And what that basically means is, in the military, commanders have judicial authority, which is very kind of unusual for civilians to hear that, you know, within the military, a commander who has no legal training actually has the authority to determine whether or not a case in his or her unit goes to trial. And you know, before this change was made by the Secretary of Defense, and it's actually being pushed through Congress right now as well, junior commanders, you know, who were, you know, in their 20s, had only spent a few years in the military, were very close in age, and also literally directly supervising the alleged perpetrator and alleged mm-hmm. victim, were the ones making that decision about whether or not a alleged perpetrator would go to trial. Right now, it's going up to the 06 or colonel level. It's, you know, it's a step forward. The problem is that oftentimes officers at the 06 level are also complicit in these cover-ups. And in some cases, they are also the sexual predators themselves. And so how does a victim get that sense that there's no bias in the system? And does she or he feel safe even reporting within that chain of command? And so there's no separate body within the military like there is in the civilian world. In the civilian world, you have prosecutors determining case disposition. In other words, you know, your local DA is determining whether or not he or she's going to prosecute a rapist. In the military, it's that commander now at the colonel level who has that final word over whether or not a case is going to go to court-martial.
And Amy, we're almost up on a break here, but what we hear from a number of the women and some men that you talked to as well is that the military was a family, and they joined it in many cases because they came from military families and then had to deal with sexual assault.
Yeah, that's what made the betrayal so difficult, so traumatizing, and so hard for many people to get over, was also part of the whole military ethos. Is this is your family, we're here to take care of you, we have your back, you know, and everyone's in this together. And then to be assaulted, not from an enemy without, but an enemy within, and then not to be have anything done about that, and not to be believed, and not to have any recourse to a justice system, really causes it. It's a kind of core betrayal that really, really hard for people to overcome.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Amy Ziering. She's the producer of a documentary called The Invisible War about the issue and the problem of sexual assault in the U.S. military. Also with us, Anu Bhagwati. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Longwood Gardens supports WHYY. Nestled in the heart of the Brandywine Valley, Longwood Gardens invites visitors to experience the performing arts in a garden setting. Longwood presents an outdoor performance featuring the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra on Wednesday, July 11th at 7:30 p.m. Program highlights include the works of Bach, Mendelssohn, and Elgar. Tickets include all-day admission to the gardens. Tickets and details at longwoodgardens.org.
It's a Capital Four 2012. This Independence Day, join me, Corva Coleman, with onstage host Tom Bergeron as the stars come out to sing and celebrate America's biggest birthday party. We'll hear R&B legends Kool & the Gang, Broadway great Kelly O'Hara, a tribute to America's Olympic athletes, the National Symphony Orchestra, and more. Don't miss a Capital Four 2012 live from NPR Music.
Tomorrow night at 8 on WHYY.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. On August 3rd, WHYY-TV and PBS stations across the country will be premiering a new documentary produced locally by WHYY. The Barnes Collection tells the story of Dr. Albert C. Barnes and his impressive art collection. Support WHYY's local productions with a $120 donation and we'll thank you by sending you two tickets to visit the Barnes Foundation's new home on the Ben Franklin Parkway. Call 1-888-345-9499 or visit WHYY.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Amy Ziering and Anu Bhagwati, and I do want to play another scene from this documentary, The Invisible War. And from the film, Donna McAleer, author of a book called Porcelain on Steel, says the, quote, Marine barracks in Washington, D.C. is the most prestigious unit there is in the Marine Corps. This is the unit where the best of the best go. It's the Marine Corps showcase ceremonial unit. It handles presidents and dignitaries. And these are some of the voices of women Marines. Let's listen.
After my deployment to Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2008-2009, my commanding officer recommended me for the Marine Barracks Washington. I was excited. It was the tip of the spear as far as the Marine Corps is concerned. One of the first things I was told when I checked in was, don't wear any makeup because the Marines will all think that you want to sleep with them. And I thought, that's just ridiculous.
The atmosphere off the bat at Marine Barracks Washington was horrible. People asked me what sexual favors had I performed to get my orders there.
There was a senior officer in my command who, the first time he spoke to me, he said, female Marines here are nothing but objects for the Marines to.
So the minute a female shows up at my work, she's immediately pounced on. All of the new females get talked about, saying that they're having sex, sleeping with so-and-so. Apparently, I slept with all these men, and, I mean, I didn't.
Anna, you are a Marine officer. You served as a Marine officer from 1999 to 2004. We're talking about the Marine barracks in Washington, D.C. Again, I guess it's the first question I put to you as well. And you had mentioned the fact that you knew of cases of sexual assault when you served in the Marine Corps. What does this tell us?
I think, the Marine Corps is largely considered by the American public as a very elite branch of service. We, refer to the few, the proud. What people might take for granted is how few women are in the Marine Corps and just how hostile an environment it is for women, both on the enlisted and officer side. It's only 6% female, for the two or three officers that were featured in Amy and Kirby's film. They were stationed at one of the most elite units within the Marine Corps. It's very close to the Capitol. The Presidential Guard comes from there, and all eyes are on there. It was shocking to sort of see that there's this pattern of a sexual assault and cover-ups at Marine Barracks, mm-hmm. Washington, but unfortunately, I can't say I'm surprised, because the larger culture within the Marine Corps condones misogyny, it condones sexual harassment broadly, and in my own experience and currently working, as the director of an organization working on sexual assault in the military, we still see Marines regularly being retaliated against for reporting sexual assault.
Amy, let me quote something that I saw in the Christian Science Monitor, the Marine Corps issuing a sobering acknowledgement of the pervasiveness of sexual assault within its ranks, and the report read, despite our efforts, we have been ineffective at addressing and eliminating sexual assault. I know you have to leave us in a couple of minutes. What do you want your film to do?
Well, we very much hope that this will start a real dialogue and awareness in the public consciousness about this issue. That would be incredibly helpful, and that's a real primary hope, because once there's a massive consciousness about something that's going on, it's very hard for it to continue in the way it has. The second thing we hope is the military sees this as a real opportunity, an opportunity to sort of recognize an issue, own it, and take the necessary measures to change it. We hope that this now in etches this on the consciousness, not only the public, but the military, in a way that impels the military to finally sort of take this issue with the seriousness that it needs to and exert all the powers that it has, remarkable powers it has, to really take this on and sort of end the needless suffering and really go after the enemies within, investigate them, prosecute them, and give survivors the immediate support they need so that their trauma does not have to be magnified exponentially by all that they suffer in this aftermath.
Your interviews are based in part on a lawsuit of victims, survivors, as you call them, who have charged sexual assault and looking, obviously, for some justice. What happened to that lawsuit?
Well, there's been several lawsuits now. Susan Burke keeps filing them. The first one was dismissed, and she's appealed it, and it's still awaiting appeal. And the other two have just recently been filed, and she's awaiting to file another one. So her plan is to just keep going until she finds, you know, a sympathetic judge, and this can move up to the Supreme Court, so that the civil rights of our service members are protected.
We talked a bit about Corey, who served in the U.S. Coast Guard. This film was shown at the Sundance Film Festival. What's her status, and has she been able to get some help for her medical and physical problems?
Well, it was pretty amazing. After the first screening at Sundance, some private citizens who were in the audience stepped up and said they wanted to help her and pay for her medical surgery. So she is getting help. Unfortunately, it's not from the VA and from the military, but it is from private citizens, and that's really incredible, and she's very grateful.
And part of the film is we see her on the phone, we see her going to try to get support from, what is it, the VA, I guess?
Yeah, she was trying to, she was talking to the benefits department of the VA.
And on the hold, waiting for responses? I think we might have lost Amy. I'm not sure. Anu, does that surprise you?
Well, one of the things that I thought was fantastic about the film was that scene where Corey is on the phone with VBA, the Veterans Benefits Administration, which is something that any veteran, you know, applying for benefits is very used to. I mean, the long lines, staying on hold for hours sometimes, you know, waiting in lines at the VA medical centers for hours. What is very unique for military sexual trauma survivors who are applying for benefits for conditions like post-traumatic stress or depression or anxiety disorders, what is unique about that is it's even harder to get your disability compensation for that trauma than it would be for a combat veteran. And that's something that we still need to educate the American public about, that it's, while it's extremely difficult right now for all veterans coming back from Iraq, right, Afghanistan, and prior wars like Vietnam, to get benefits for all the conditions that they suffered for their service, the burden of proof on military sexual trauma survivors is even higher than it would be for a veteran whose conditions arise from combat or deployment. And so we're trying to fix that system so that you know, veterans don't have to you know, suffer even more while they're applying for compensation from VA than they already have.
And Amy, I know you have to go. We've got you back on the line.
That's
okay. Any final thoughts before we say an official goodbye to you? And thanks for joining us. Anything else you want to add?
No, I think I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time. And,
sure,
you know, I'm really grateful to all the media that's now sort of taking this issue and trying to help expose it and raise awareness about it. So.
Well, I thank you for making the film and joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that's bye-bye. That's Amy Ziering, producer of a documentary we've been talking about called The Invisible War. It's a new documentary. It examines the issue, the problem of sexual assault in the U.S. military. She's an Emmy-nominated, award-winning producer and director. In fact, conducted many of the interviews in this documentary. Staying with us for the rest of the hour, Anu Bhagwati, executive director and co-founder of Service Women's Action Network, a former captain and company commander. She served as a Marine officer from 1999 to 2004. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Particularly want to hear from the military people in our audience. Let me get Jean from Morristown to join us on Radio Times. And Jean, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I called to say I was in the Air Force in the late 70s, early 80s. And I had a bad sexual experience.
I'm sorry.
I was basically gang raped.
I'm
One
so
night,
sorry.
My roommate had a guy in the room, and so I ended up sitting in the common room because I didn't like what was going on in the women's common room, and one of the, I was very young. I was only 18. And this, one of the guys from the men's dorm, you know, he was like, you know, Mr. Super Handsome Wonderful. And I never thought he'd have pain. He talked, sat down and started talking to me. And he said, well, you don't have anywhere to sleep. Why don't you come sleep in my room? And I was like, I guess I'm okay, you know, with that. It never occurred to me anything would happen. I that's really naive of me, I guess. And he took me in, and, you know, I figured we were going to mess around, but, you know, he had turned out the lights, and, you know, we were starting to have sex, and then his roommate came in, and then other men started just coming in and coming. I have no idea how many came in. They just started coming in and coming in. And the next day I told my roommate and my girlfriends, and they said, don't report it because they're not going to do anything about it.
Oh, Jean, I'm so sorry. Hold on one second. I want to give Anu Bhagwati a chance to respond. Now, Jean's talking about something that happened in the 70s and 80s. Are we beginning to sort of unearth these stories?
Yes, and first, hi, Jean. I'm so glad you called in, and I don't know if this is the first time you've talked about your experience, but thanks for stepping forward, because I think what we've learned is every time a woman or a man who's a veteran steps forward and shares their experience, there are lots of people listening, and they're finding inspiration from you for sharing, so thank you very much. Yeah. And you called yourself naive, and I would encourage you to be kinder to yourself, because this had nothing to do with your behavior. This was not about you. And those guys committed a crime, and it's their fault, and they're the ones who should be held accountable, not you. And I hope, you know, if you need any resources, you know, feel free to call us, or we could refer you to any other support services too, because there's a huge community now that's developing around veterans like you, who have been through some of these awful experiences. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Thank you. It was I don't know. I was told that they wouldn't believe me, and I only told one. I tried to tell, he was called an STA, he said, you know, that you should just forget about it. And so pretty much I did.
Well, Jean, you have provided a real service to our listeners today on Radio Times. It took a lot of courage on your part. We can hear the emotion in your voice, and it's important to talk about these. And hopefully you've got somebody that you can talk to who knows you, who's part of your kinship or your friendship, you know, can help you through it.
Thank you.
You know, thank you very much, Jean, for calling into Radio Times. Anu, it's very emotional to hear these particular stories, of course. And there's a father in this documentary whose daughter, Hannah Sewell, talks about being assaulted. And she talks about losing her virginity and telling her father that she's no longer a virgin. And he's a military guy. And his upset is so palpable and so real.
It is. I mean, no parent wants to know that their child has been raped or assaulted or harmed in any way. And it's very hard, I think, for, you know, uniformed personnel, you know, military families who have committed decades to serving the United States to know that their children who have also volunteered to serve in this all-volunteer force are being abused by people that we work with and that we trust our lives with. And it's an extremely painful scene. I think it's important to see, to witness, you know, it was a sergeant major who was talking about his daughter, and also there's a former Marine captain who is talking about his wife who's been raped. And, you know, both of these men were transformed in seeing how their family members were betrayed, retaliated against, punished for you know, after they were victimized in the first place. And it's a very common experience. I think people just have no idea kind of the psychology that develops, and also the extent to which sexual predators manipulate and exploit their victims. I mean, you heard Jean talk about, you know, how she was basically, you know, set up for this gang rape. And that's extremely common, you know, as the documentary points out. sexual predators tend to be serial predators. So they don't just commit one or two crimes during the course of their life. They can commit, you know, dozens upon dozens of sexual assaults and rapes. And so for every victim that we know about, there are dozens more that we may never hear from, who have all been harmed by the same man. And it's just a, you know, until you stop that cycle of violence by holding that person accountable and making sure that commanders know that you cannot let these guys go. You have to punish them. It's not an option, because if you don't, if you just simply transfer them to another unit, just get rid of him, you know, so you don't have to deal with him. Let him continue raping other women or men, you know, in another unit, or, you know, just let him retire without being court-martialed, which is another option. But 10-11% of sexual predators for the last 3 years have been allowed to resign in lieu of court-martial, which basically means that they will be raping and assaulting people in civilian neighborhoods instead of targeting women and men in the military.
In fact, so at the end of this film, we see that the women that have spoken and the people that they accuse of assaulting them, and many of them still in the military. Still, maybe they're at another base, but still within the military.
Absolutely. And I mean, I can tell you from serving in the Marine Corps, you know, a lot of the officers who were implicated in the cover-ups that I witnessed, both sexual assault and sexual harassment, are still in the Marine Corps. They're just senior ranking now. They've been promoted one or two levels since I left. And so, you know, not only have they not been held accountable, but they've been promoted and given more authority and responsibility over their troops.
Clearly, we hear from Gene, and we know from Tailhook and from other scandals and allegations that this is a problem. Now we've got the head of the Defense Department, Leon Panetta, saying we're going to take this seriously. We hear from the Marine Corps. Do you think the military is ready to address this particular issue?
The military is about as ready as it can be. I mean, you know, the big story right now is Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, which is where Air Force recruits are trained. So if you're joining the Air Force, you are going straight to Lackland to be trained by drill instructors, many of whom have just been rounded up and several of whom are being court-martialed as we speak. But, you know, 31 women were victims, or those are the ones who've stepped forward to report their assaults or rapes or what the military is calling inappropriate conduct or misconduct by drill instructors. And so, I mean, that's an example of the Air Force actually doing the right thing. Now, there were several things that led up to this kind of scandal, including cover-ups, including, you know, instructors not stepping forward to do the right thing, including, you know, victims being terrified and not knowing how to report, just that culture of silence, again, kind of feeding in on itself. But once one of the victims stepped forward, the whole thing broke. And you know, we're grateful to the reporter in Texas Sid Christensen, for actually breaking that story. But it's not uncommon. You know, every 10 years or so, we see a giant sexual assault scandal erupting in the military. We know about Aberdeen, you know, the Air Force Academy, Tailhook. It goes on. And so the culture itself has not yet transformed.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers, talking with Anu Bagwati, Executive Director, co-founder of Service Women's Action Network, a former captain and company commander. She served as a Marine officer from 1999 to 2004. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Next time in Studio 360, we roll out the red and white carpet. The 1st of July is Canada Day.
Yes, you didn't know we had a Canada Day?
I knew.
We have a capital, too, our nation's capital.
So, and I've been to Ottawa.
That's a good start.
Gian Gomeshi, the host of the CBC's Q, returns to test my knowledge of Canada. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, if you're barbecuing fish and it slips through the grill, what do you do?
Do you have a cat? Because that cat's going to eat well. You're pretty much done. At that point, you've sacrificed the fish to the charcoal gods.
Advice from Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop of America's Test Kitchen. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's daytime news magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about sexual assault within the U.S. military and what to do about it. And again, Anu Bhagwati, our guest, executive director, co-founder of Service Women's Action Network. And she served as a Marine officer from 1999 to 2004. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Lee from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Lee, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to call. I am so glad that this film has been made, and I'm really grateful that this issue has been receiving so much attention. One thing I wanted to comment on is I think it's very important that in all sorts of media coverage that we focus more on the perpetrator rather than on the victim of the crime. There needs to be a documentary about the men or the people who are committing these sexual assaults. And for media to really broaden their reporting rather than simply focusing on victims after the fact. The other thing is I think that the military needs to work harder on sexual violence prevention through education. That's something that should be done in schools as well as in other cultural contexts to really change the way that we think about these issues.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much, Lee, for calling in. I should say to our listeners that the perpetrators are not named or seen in this film, and it is a film not about them, but about these largely women and some men who have stepped forward as well. Anu Bhagwati, picking up on what Lee said about the importance of education, what is the military doing to address the education of people within the U.S. military?
Well, I think Lee makes some great points. One of the things that we saw the Marine Corps put out a couple weeks ago, they disseminated a 27-page report, their plan to sort of reduce sexual assault in the Marine Corps. And one of the key components of that was a focus on victims, on what their behavior was and reducing their at-risk behavior. And that sort of goes back to Lee's point, which is not only does the media tend to focus on the victim's story and behavior and where she was and what she was wearing and whether or not alcohol was involved in the incident, which is all sort of part of what we call rape mythology, but there's no discussion of what the perpetrators have done and the nature of the crime and what the crime is all about and the fact that sexual harassment often precedes sexual assault and that stalking is a component of sexual assault oftentimes. Again, to go back to Jean's experience, there is a lot that leads up to a sexual assault. Most sexual offenders know their victims, and so that is sort of evidence of the fact that they manipulate that relationship and exploit the relationship so that they can get whatever they want out of it. But that focus on training is a little bit, I think, misleading, because the military over the last few years has focused on increasing training, and I think it can be dangerous just to focus on training. In the military, oftentimes, when we talk about death by PowerPoint, I mean, troops don't like being educated through PowerPoint slides, and unfortunately, with what the military tends to consider personnel issues like sexual assault and harassment, PowerPoint presentations and that kind of training and education methodology isn't very effective, and it certainly is not helpful in transforming military culture as deeply as we need it to be transformed. And what's necessary, therefore, isn't just training. It's actually the reform of not just the military judicial system, but also what victims have in terms of access to remedies. And right now, service members do not have access to civil remedies, which is something that is available to civilian victims of sexual assault. So, for instance, what I'm referring to is if you're the victim of a sexual assault in the civilian world, you can sue for damages in civil court. A service member cannot do that, which is very shocking. So if you're the victim of medical malpractice or sexual assault or racial discrimination or any other sort of form of negligence or a crime, you are limited to the criminal justice system, oftentimes within the military, right? But not having access to civil relief is one of the key components that is causing the military to be held back by decades. You can't, there's no deterrent right now to rapists in the military. There's no deterrent to commanders that are sweeping these incidents under the rug. Now, there would be a deterrent if victims could, you know, one day, you know, wake up and say, you know what, I'm going to sue you. I'm going to sue you, Marine Corps or Army, or I'm going to sue you, you know, perpetrator or you know, my commanding officer, because you failed to do the right thing when I reported. Right? Now, that would change the military practically overnight. And that is something that our government, our Congress members have got to institutionalize. And we are fighting as hard as we can to make sure that someday, very soon, civil remedies are accessible to service members.
Lee, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. This goes back to the film, The Invisible War, and an interview with a Dr. Kay Whitley. She's responsible for prevention and victim care. And I have to say, the interview with her was as disturbing as the interviews with some of the victims of sexual assault, because of her inability to answer questions and to frankly give answers that would give, it seems to me, comfort to anyone that had been victimized within the U.S. military.
Right. Well, she was in charge of the Sexual Assault Prevention Response Office, which is sort of the department within the Department of Defense that deals with sexual assault. Unfortunately, SAPRO, which is the acronym for the department, is very limited in its mandate. And so it has nothing to do with prosecution of crimes. It has nothing to do with law enforcement or, you know, sentencing guidelines or anything like that. It has nothing to do with the perpetrators, right? It has nothing to do with punishment. It basically is involved in coming up with training methodology and data collection. And so it serves a purpose that's useful for us. I mean, certainly the data we get, even though it's very limited, we know that there are, you know, approximately 20,000 sexual assaults committed each year in the military because of this data. But, you know, to expect anything more of SAPRO is very short-sighted of us. And I think you know, the documentary was great that it shone a light on SAPRO. But SAPRO can't fix the problem in any way, shape, or form. You can't fix rapists. You can't cure them of their criminal behavior with a bunch of sophisticated posters, you know, with what's called bystander intervention. You have to hold perpetrators accountable for their crimes.
Yeah, sorry about that. Let me get David from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi, Marty.
Hi.
I wanted to not steer away from the fear of punishment, and for bureaucracies, they have to fear litigation, and, you know, look at the Catholic Church and others. But I did want to get back to the notion of intervention with men, but not the perpetrators. You know, it's more like, this is generally across society, it's the people in the middle who either cheer it on or maybe think, oh, no big deal, let's have a beer. And I think that's something that's really important, because punishment on the one hand is important, but then, and I think PowerPoint is like the worst way. In fact, you want to encourage people to ignore it. I'm wondering if there's approaches with media and film, because, you know, it's the people in the middle who ultimately will decide whether to tolerate this kind of behavior, except for the worst offenders who will avoid everybody.
I hear you.
Does your guest have any thoughts about that?
David, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I know it seems like those are the bystanders that we hear about.
Right. And David makes a great point. To use a very recent example, there was a drill instructor at Lackland Air Force Base who waited a month before he reported his fellow instructors. And you've got to wonder, I mean, he was really wrestling with this, right? Because he knew that they were up to something, that they were seriously exploiting some of these recruits, but he didn't speak for 4 whole weeks. Now, I don't know how many assaults were committed within the 4 weeks that he was sort of wrestling, you know, with his own, moral issues or whatever it was. But that is so common. You know, thank goodness he came forward at the end of that 4 weeks. But many people stay silent. They choose to look the other way. And I mean, that's true, I think, generally of human beings. But in the military in particular, you have, you know, this very extreme level of indoctrination, which works great, again, in an operational environment because you need people to function well as a unit and not do their own thing, right? But again, when it comes to what I would consider moral courage issues, that's where that kind of tendency toward groupthink really breaks down for a victim, right? Because she or he needs the support of individuals, roommates and neighbors and other people in the chain of command to step forward and to go against the grain. So clearly there needs to be a little more incentive for the average troop to be supported as he or she's stepping forward to say, hey, you know what, you know, my roommate was raped and I'm going to stick up for her. Unfortunately, oftentimes, again, with this culture of retaliation, whistleblowers themselves are also punished, right? And I sort of look at this whole issue as a whistleblowing issue because oftentimes you're going against the grain of the entire culture, either as a victim who's stepping forward or as a witness or a bystander who's stepping forward. And we need to encourage and promote all of those women and men who are stepping forward.
I'm sorry, David. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. We actually had a caller wanted to know, are there female perpetrators, or are we talking about male perpetrators largely?
There are female perpetrators, and that's true throughout society, but the vast majority are male perpetrators. So, you know, for those survivors out there who've been assaulted by women, absolutely, we don't want to discount your experiences, right. But the vast majority of perpetrators are male. And what I think is also extremely important to get across is on the victim side, overwhelmingly there's ignorance about sort of gender. And so we assume that this is a women's issue, that most victims are women. But what we know from VA data is that almost half of the veterans being treated for sexual trauma, military sexual trauma, at VA medical centers across the nation are men. Almost half. And so we may see, certainly the Invisible War puts a lot of attention on women victims, but there are so many male victims that have not yet come forward or are only coming forward after mm-hmm. their military experience and are sort of, beginning that healing process in the VA or after service. So that culture of silence affects men in different ways and sometimes in even, more pervasive ways.
And I guess there is that sort of suck it up culture that is so much a part of the military.
Absolutely. And, there's unfortunately, I think men in general in our society are not educated about sexual violence. There's so much ignorance about what it means to be a victim of sexual violence. And because there's so much rape mythology, because, we teach young people sort of all the wrong things, that they're to blame, they wore the wrong thing, that they got themselves into this situation, that they should have known better, which is all the wrong messaging. Mm-hmm. Men are not only not acclimated to know that there are sexual predators out there and that rape is about power. Rape is about violence. And so if you are a victim of sexual assault, it was not about you or what you wear or what you said or what you did, right? It is about the subjugation of the human spirit at the end of the day. And men need to be educated about that. Many men assume that they're gay. And again, there's a lot of homophobia that's mixed into this messaging about rape mythology. And we know that it has nothing to do with sexual orientation. Again, it has to do with power. And so there's been a lot of work we've had to do around, repeal of don't ask, don't tell. And that actually doesn't mean that men are going to be raping men. I mean, mm-hmm. there's absolutely, egregious messaging around sexuality, sexual orientation, and sexual assault.
But I wonder whether there isn't an advantage in the military. I understand what you're saying about the chain of command, even the bureaucracy in the military, but if especially at high levels there are orders about what you can and cannot do, whether that trickles down to the bottom of the military rungs, and that's an advantage that the military might have that the civilian world doesn't have.
It's true. I mean, the military likes to say that, you know, when they're going to fix the problem, they're going to do it the best, right? I mean, and the Marine Corps, you know, during kind of the debate about don't ask, don't tell, said, well, we're going to repeal it the best. We're going to implement this policy the best, right? Even though it arguably it's the most homophobic branch in the military. But there is something to say for the military kind of taking the lead in terms of whatever kind of issue it's been tasked to deal with. I do believe that if the military truly embraces this issue, that they can be a leader, that they absolutely can lead the way for the rest of civilian society if they take this seriously. Mm-hmm. But that means they need to absolutely hammer away at perpetrators and the commanders who protect them. And that is a very, you know, that's a big step that they need to take. You know, when we see commanders being court-martialed for failing to prosecute sexual predators, I will say, you know what, the culture has changed, because that's how seriously we're taking this issue. We're not even going to let commanders get away with this.
Well, we could talk more. In fact, I wanted to talk to you about the Pentagon opening up new jobs for women in the military, but we'll save that for another day. Anu Bhagwati, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Executive Director, co-founder of the Service Women's Action Network, former captain, company commander, served as a Marine officer from 1999 to 2004. She joined us from the NPR Bureau in New York City. Also spoke with Amy Ziering, and she's the producer of a documentary called The Invisible War. It's about the problem of sexual assault in the U.S. military. She's an Emmy-nominated, I should say, award-winning producer and director. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this show. I'm Marty Moscoen. Stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.